The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast. Hang up and listen for the week of April 3rd, 2017. On this week's show, Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post will join us to talk about the women's Final Four, wherein Mississippi State snapped UConn's 111-game winning streak and then went on to lose to South Carolina in the national title game. We'll also discuss Gonzaga and North Carolina's wins at the men's Final Four, as well as Oregon forward Jordan Bell's post-game self-flagellation, in which he insisted the Ducks' one-point loss to UNC was all his fault. Finally, we'll assess the Raiders' move to Las Vegas and a couple other stories in a hang-up lightning round. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Hello, Josh.
With us from a hotel room in Atlanta, which he presumably booked to guarantee he would have access to a high-quality podcasting robe, it is our honored guest for the day, Joel Anderson of BuzzFeed News. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Josh, Stefan. Pleasure to be on here.
We're very happy to have you and just glad that you're comfortable.
Oh, yeah. It's a Hyatt place. It's in Buckhead. I'm doing pretty well, I'd say. But I do have to check out at 1 o'clock. So.
All right. We'll talk really fast.
Just, right.
You know, we'll allow you ample time to pack. We've got the Hang Up and Listen survey still going on. We're going to keep that open for another week. If you have thoughts on what we're doing on the show and what you'd like to hear, who you'd like to hear, go to slate.com/survey. In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to talk about a subject that is near and dear to Joel's heart. Maybe Joel's favorite subject in all the world, Mr. LeVar Ball, provocateur, basketball dad.
Oh, my God.
Hang up and listen, guest.
Join Slate Plus to hear about LeVar Ball and other basketball dads. It's just $49 a year, and you'll get bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. And you can sign up for that at slate.com/hangup+. On Sunday night in Dallas, South Carolina beat Mississippi State 67-55 to win its first national title in women's basketball. The most remarkable win of the weekend, though, went to those Mississippi State Bulldogs. They had lost to Connecticut in last year's NCAA tournament by 60 points. This year, the Bulldogs and the Huskies were tied at 64 in overtime, which is way better than being down, for example, 64-4. Anyway, here is what it sounded like when Mississippi State had the ball and the clock was winding down in overtime.
Dillingham across midcourt. Dillingham with it. Five to get off a shot. William on the drive. Pull up, pull up. Mississippi State in overtime at the buzzer.
Joining us now is the Washington Post's Sally Jenkins, who was at the Final Four in Dallas. Hey, Sally.
Hey there.
So I just want you to tell us what it was like in those last 10 seconds of the Mississippi State-UConn game.
Well, the main thing it was like was the noise. I mean, you know, it was like this avalanche coming down from the stands because everybody's on their feet screaming in the American Airlines Center. And then here comes this little kid who, you know, it's the 45th minute of the game and, you know, she does a couple of crossover dribbles and finds a little space and she goes up in the face of Gabby Williams, the defensive player of the year in women's college basketball, who's bigger than her by about 7 inches. And she gets this shot up, and she elevates, and you just can't believe that in that minute of the game she still had enough left to elevate like that. And then the shot just drops through, and the place exploded. It was a moment that women's basketball hadn't had too many of those type of moments. It was a great moment for the game.
You're talking about Morgan William, of course, the 5'5" point guard for Mississippi State, and
who, by the way, is closer to 5'3" than 5'5". They list her at 5'5". as my father would say, she might be 5'5", standing in cleats on a hardwood floor.
And when you look at the photo, the image of her elevating,
yeah,
she's up around, you know, she's up at around her waist.
Yeah.
It was incredible at that moment, and that really struck me, too. What happened on UConn's final possession, though? There are two things that I took away from that game. And one, UConn did not play very well. And when Gino Auriemma, the coach of UConn, has his team not there, his team isn't playing well, you can see it on his face. And he had that look of bemusement after Morgan Williams hit that last shot. I thought he handled himself pretty well after the game, but clearly he couldn't have been pleased with his team's performance. How do you think he handled it afterward, too?
Oh, I thought he was terrific. I mean, he was everything you would hope the leader and voice of the game would be. He was very gracious. Yeah. You know, it was inevitable. They were going to lose eventually. The remarkable thing about UConn's 111-game streak is that not one time in those 111 games did they beat themselves. And they didn't beat themselves the other night either. I mean, they shot the ball in the high 40%. Now, they didn't execute on a couple of things down the stretch, and they missed a couple free throws. But they did not play badly. A lot of that was inflicted by Mississippi State's defense and quickness. So, you know, I thought that he understood and recognized that. He recognized that, you know, his kids had gotten him to a Final Four when no one thought they had, you know, a chance to start the season after losing Breanna Stewart and Morgan Tuck and Mariah Jefferson, you know, the top three players in the WNBA draft. And you come back with a bunch of understudies who really did everything he had asked of them all year long. So, I just thought he was very gracious, and it was what you would have hoped for from, you know, the leader of the game.
Yeah, it was a great message. It was about the totality of the experience, he said, not the final result.
And he also said something that really coaches should say more of, which is, you know, kids should hope that's the worst moment of their life.
Right.
And the fact is that it won't be. You know, life is much harder than basketball, and so I think he did a good job of keeping it in perspective.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, UConn is the Goliath in women's college basketball. But the one thing about Mississippi State is that they didn't have to beat all those other UConn teams, right? They didn't have to beat the team with Breanna Stewart. They didn't, you know, this was of these champions of recent vintage, this was probably the weakest team, right? And so, like, that's all you need. Like, they were just weak enough. Mississippi State, you know, came back with a lot of the same team that had lost about 60 the year before. Everybody's you're better, older, and then they've got this, like, this tremendous motivation to beat a team that had humiliated them the year before. So, I mean, yeah, in a one game sample, that's the sort of thing that can happen. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing maybe Gino expects to win a championship every year. I don't know, but. If you were going to lose, this would be the year that you would lose, right?
Yeah, and not only that, but I think it hurts less to lose on a shot like that. I mean, as Auriemma said, you know, that's one of the hardest shots to hit in basketball. You know, she's dribbling hard. Morgan Williams has to drive hard, create space, stop on a dime, and get up a 15-footer. You know, they talked in the huddle, don't give up the three. Don't give up the dribble drive to the basket and foul. But the, you know, they basically said if they're going to beat us, they're going to have to beat us with a pull up, you know, from outside of a certain range. And that's just exactly what happened. I mean, as Auriemma said, you can't think up a harder shot to hit in that moment.
So this was not the case where UConn was the Soviet Union and then South Carolina was Finland. This was the case where UConn was Rafael Nadal, Mississippi State was Robin Soderling. Then they lost in the final. Was it surprising to you that Mississippi State lost by 12 to South Carolina in the final game? Morgan William, I think, even said this was like winning the championship. ... Even though, you know, we still know we have a game left to play.
Right. I mean, that was the toughest part of preparing a team emotionally to turn around and play South Carolina. I mean, they knew how good South Carolina was. They've lost to them, I think it's 10 straight times. And, you know, South Carolina was bigger.
South Carolina was like their UConn.
Yeah, South Carolina is bigger and faster. Dawn Staley is, I think, probably the superior coach to Vic Schaefer. She's more experienced. She was in her third Final Four as a coach. She played in she was in her second Final Four as a coach, and she played in three of them as a player. and played in, you know, she's got 17 international gold medals as a player and a coach. So, I mean, I just think that she was the superior sideline presence, number one, knew how to prepare for this better. I mean, one thing I'm hearing is that Vic Schaefer ran his kids in practice on Saturday, which is a real rookie mistake in a Final Four, especially wow. after a tough overtime game the night before.
And an overtime game in the previous round.
And they have to beat Baylor in overtime to get to the Final Four. Then they've got to beat UConn. So they have to beat two top seeds in overtime and play a third top seed in South Carolina that you know is going to make you play on the run.
That doesn't
Why
sound like a mistake. That sounds insane.
For 2 hours on Saturday when you only got 3 hours sleep and you got to come back the very next afternoon. I mean, my understanding is that Dawn Staley had her team doing yoga, you know? So I just think I think the turnaround was going to be tough under any circumstances, but I think their coach complicated it, probably misplayed his hand. And then I thought that for him to bench Morgan William in the fourth quarter of that game was probably one of the most disgraceful things I've ever seen a head coach do.
Oh, I want to get to that. One point I want to make before we talk about that is that to me, it was clear that South Carolina was the far superior team. You mentioned quicker, faster, stronger. The three best players on the basketball court were Asia Wilson, Alicia Gray, and Kayla Davis. Yep. By far in that game, it was clearly, UConn in terms of talent matched up much better with South Carolina than Mississippi State did. And they were exposed. They were exposed in the fourth quarter particularly. It was 54-50. Mississippi State cut that lead with about 6.5 minutes to go. And then it ended up 66-52. And Morgan William was on the bench for that entire run, the entire fourth quarter. You were talking about it on Twitter. I was responding. Some other people chimed in. This, to me, was utterly disgraceful. You take a woman, a young woman, who delivered the most dramatic shot possibly in the history of women's college basketball, and then you effectively humiliate her on national television when your audience is bigger than it's ever been because of what she had done. I was watching the fourth quarter stunned that she was glued to the bench, and all I could think was either she's hurt or she did something outrageous that would demand her being benched.
Well, that's the thing. You know, if it's a major disciplinary problem, that's one thing. But if it's a performance issue, you don't do that to a kid. You work with them. You know, you coach them through it. If they're low energy or their legs are dead or they're tired, I mean, look, that Morgan William, according to her coach and her teammates, is one of the hardest working, nicest kids on that team. Okay? All weekend long, all we heard was how much gut she had, how hardworking she was, what a great attitude she had. Vic Schaefer himself talked about it on and on, about how he knew what kind of tough, great, hardworking kids he had in that locker room. So it is really hard to conceive of a reason that he would do that to her in that moment, unless it was sheer cruelty and he wanted to basically ruin the experience for her.
Which is what he did. I mean, let's not forget, this is a 34-4 team. She started every game, second in scoring on the team, led the team in steals. It was embarrassing.
Right. I mean, you're talking about a kid, you're talking about a junior who's put, first of all, 3 years of sweat equity into the program and presumably done everything you've been asked to do because you're the starting point guard. You're an honorable mention All-American. You're a team leader that everybody talks about as the beating heart of the squad, and you've delivered a performance for the ages in the tournament, throughout the tournament, to get your team to the brink of a championship, and now you're going to bench her in the fourth quarter for being a little low energy? I mean, that is coaching malpractice, among other things. It beggars the imagination. I don't know any coach who was anything other than baffled and actually rather upset by what they saw from him. And I think he owes the kid and the whole team an apology. You don't bail on a kid and betray a kid in that moment. I watched Diana Taurasi go 1-for-15 against Notre Dame in the Final Four as a freshman. Oriyema left her on the floor to play through it, worked with her in every timeout. And when he finally pulled her, when they were losing to Notre Dame by 90-75, he went over and sat down next to her and put an arm around her. That's how you handle a kid in that moment.
Joel, you're a huge Dawn Staley fan, right? What do you admire so much about her?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I mean, she was on an episode of Martin when I was a kid. So, I mean, that was a big thing. but, I mean... If we're talking about like the star, like if there was, Mount Rushmore is like a cliched construction, right? But like if there is one of those for women's basketball in like the last, quarter century, then like Dawn Staley probably is on it. She's won 3 Olympic gold medals. She's a 6-time WNBA All-Star. Maybe the closest comparison, and I saw, Sally, you said Bill Russell is maybe the best comparison. I said maybe Jerry West for what she's accomplished as a player and as like an executive, essentially. It's tough to think of somebody else who's had a career like that where they were great. They were legitimately great as a player and then great in the latter half of their career when they moved into the front office or into the head coaching seat. It's just sort of remarkable. There's not a lot of examples like that. And the fact is that she didn't even want to be a coach. She thought she was going to be playing, the whole time. And now she's, become one of the greatest coaches. So far, you'd have to say she's one of the 3 or 4 best coaches left in the game right now.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is that most of the people who played with her and that she played for as a player at Virginia and a player for USA Basketball thought that she could certainly be a coach if she wanted to. She ran the U.S. Olympic team for 16 years. Most of her head coaches deferred to her. Nell Fortner, who I talked to last night, said, Staley would come running over to the sideline and say, we need to do this. And Nell would just, who was the head coach of the Olympic gold medal team, would just say, okay, Dawn, go do it. Yeah, let's do that. So I think she was a floor coach long before she took on the actual title. And it was the Temple athletic director talked her into it and said, come back home to Philly and try this. I think you'd be really good at it. And, she just was automatically, instantly so good at it. She, her very first season when she's a player, she's still a WNBA player, she coached Temple to their best season in a decade. So she's just a natural. She really is. And, I think she's a really formidable new rival for the Blue Bloods, for the Connecticuts and the Baylors and the Tennessees and the other traditional powers in women's college basketball. I think she's here to stay. And the interesting thing about her is that she doesn't seem to ever get tired of winning.
So much winning.
So what is the significance, especially this week with the conversation based largely on Gina Auriemma's comments about the decline in the number of women coaching? What's the significance of Staley winning this her first national title?
Well, I think, Dawn Staley and Tara Vanderveer both, took exception to what Gino had to say. I don't think anybody thinks that he's a sexist. He's nobody's sexist. I just think people felt like he hadn't really thought through and understood the issue. He's lived in a bubble of success for so long. I think he doesn't understand that if you're a female assistant coach, particularly a black female assistant coach, and you have even one career setback or reversal, it's really, really hard to get another job when 88% of the athletic directors in the country are white men. So, I just think, like, for instance, Dawn Staley had Melanie Balcom on her bench last night. She hired Melanie Balcom as a fourth assistant coach. Melanie Balcom was head coach at Vanderbilt, made, 12 NCAA tournaments and coached Vanderbilt to the best records in school history. And when she got fired, first of all, she gets fired for that. And second of all, had real trouble finding another job that could accommodate the fact that she's the mother of 2 children under the age of 6. So it's complicated. If the number of women coaches is falling, it's there's 7 or 8 complicated interlocking factors. There's more competition for the jobs because now men want those jobs now that they pay decent salaries and they're not embarrassed to have them anymore, which they were even 25 years ago. That's number one. Number two, the makeup of the hiring roles is I think probably somewhat slanted and biased. It's an unconscious bias, but it's there.
Sally Jenkins is a writer for The Washington Post, and she was at the Final Four in Dallas, where she saw history made on Friday and saw South Carolina win on Sunday. Sally, thanks so much for being on the show.
Always enjoy it, you guys.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Unless you are a Monday early evening listener, in which case, thank you for listening so soon after the podcast is posted. The NCAA men's final will have finished up by the time you're listening to this, so congratulations to either Gonzaga or North Carolina for doing whatever it is they did. On Saturday night, let's talk about Saturday night. The Zags beat South Carolina in a quite entertaining game, and North Carolina beat Oregon by one despite missing a buttload of free throws in the last 6 seconds. Oregon's Jordan Bell, who had 16 rebounds in the game, failed to grab the ball off the boards two separate times at the end, and afterwards he blamed himself for the loss. Let's listen.
We had a good year, but I mean, we didn't reach our goal.
You were one of the last people out looking up at the scoreboard. Any thoughts running through your head, or what's going through your mind about that?
I would have just boxed out. I had two opportunities to do it. I missed both of them. We lost the game because of it.
Joel, the thing that I thought was interesting about this, two things. Number one, just how important context is for these things, because the GOAT in these situations is usually the dude who misses the free throws, right? And they were totally de-GOATified by Jordan Bell. The other thing is that boxing out is just this like very old school fundamental thing that gives absolutely no agency to the guy, you know, Kennedy Meeks, for actually acquiring the rebound. Just makes it seem like it's 100% total failure of the defensive rebounder, in this case Jordan Bell, and just gives absolutely no credit for the guy who actually did get the ball.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, we got to think about the fact that the guy that got that final rebound was somebody who had 14 rebounds in the game already. So he's pretty good at that. And we're talking about, you know, I think North Carolina is the best offensive rebounding team in the country.
Yep.
So it's not like, I mean, okay, yes, we can acknowledge Jordan Bell didn't put a body on his man, but like, come on. He gave up a rebound to the best rebounder on the top offensive rebounding team in the country. So those sorts of things are going to happen. It just seems really bad. Like if that had happened in the third, if that had happened at like the 12-minute mark of the second half, nobody would have said anything. It would have been, oh, it would have looked bad. But because it happened when it did, it looked particularly bad.
Right. I think it was Ken Pomeroy on Twitter who was saying also that like the notion of boxing out and like and that technique is very like old fashioned. It's not how people actually rebound anymore.
And also, rebounding involves not just your positioning against the man trying to out rebound you, but also where the ball bounces.
Right.
These did not look like
great point.
These did not look like egregious misses. Yeah, he didn't get his butt up against Kennedy Meeks, but still, I mean, Kennedy Meeks also made a great move to get around him and grab the ball. On the other hand, if you Google box out drills, you get over a million hits.
Oh, wow. Google. Really? So, there's that many box out drills.
Yeah, a lot of box out drills.
He should have been Googling that just
at
the free throw line.
That moment. His phone out. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, one thing to consider, too, is that, like, he had 16 rebounds. He was going against, like, a front line that was much bigger than his own. And they were missing a guy. I mean, like, you know, at that point in the – it's at this point that I remember, oh, wait, they're missing a 7-foot guy who led their team in blocks all year long.
Yeah, Chris Boucher hurt his knee, right?
Yeah, and I'm just like, well, man, you know, he had to do a lot of that banging by himself without this other guy. And, like, I just – maybe he was tired, you know? Maybe there's something to that, like, he had a lot to worry about throughout the game, and it showed up at a moment that was really inopportune for him and the Ducks. But, I mean, he's giving himself a lot of credit when he says it's all their fault that they lost. Because, I mean, it's not like Kennedy Meeks, like, just, you know, caught a break from Jordan Bell and, you know, got that rebound.
But there's a history of athletes blaming themselves. I mean, it's human nature in these kinds of moments. And in some cases, it can be tragic. And athletes don't recover and have difficulty performing afterward. And in some cases, you know, and one hopes in this case, it will be forgotten and he will go on to continue to play basketball and go to school and have a rich and fulfilling life.
No, he has no chance to have a rich and fulfilling life anymore, Stephen. It's over. It's done.
There's always the possibility he could be Scott Norwood, you know, where this just haunts him. I mean, he did say that I'll never forget this, that I'll remember this forever, you know?
Like, well, that's certainly true. Like, I remember shitty plays I made in Little League.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Nick Anderson, you were tweeting about during the game, Joel, I noticed. He missed 4 free throws in a row. That was the worst kind of choking free throw-related performance in a basketball game, I think, ever. That was game one of the NBA Finals, the Magic against the Rockets, and they were up 3, and he only had to make 1 out of 4 free throws, and he didn't make any of them. But looking at his Wikipedia entry, I didn't realize there was a kind of a happy ending, because his career fell apart, and he was down to shooting like 40% in free throws, having been a good free throw shooter. But like, In the 97-98 season, he was down to 36%. But
it's Chris Dudley.
But then towards the end of the year, his free throw shooting improved back up to 70%.
Huh.
Triumph over tragedy.
Really? Good for him.
Yeah.
I mean, as a Houston native and lifelong Houston Rockets fan, I thank him for his sacrifice. But I mean, it was terrible to see somebody like collapse like on national television in a moment that, like, you know, everybody is watching like that. You know, he had a chance to ice that game. I thought, you know, going into that game, wait, why am I talking about the 1995 NBA Finals? That's what will happen as a Houston Rockets fan, because we want people to know that we exist.
Let us talk about Gonzaga briefly. They're pretty good. They are not darlings, Cinderellas anymore, and lots of people have made that point. And I think that the semifinal game completely demonstrated that. I mean, they had South Carolina, which was also a fantastic story. Were they the 7 seed? Zero expectations, terrific defense. They had been holding teams to 0.88 points per possession. Gonzaga threw up 1.18 points per possession. And you start to realize, like, whoa, this freshman Zach Collins, this is a blue chip recruit. And if you don't follow college basketball closely and you think Gonzaga, scrappy, underdogs, recruit a lot of foreigners, you begin to realize that, no, they are among the elite in terms of getting players to come and play for them. Zach Collins, one example. Clearly, Nigel Williams-Goss, another example, a transfer who chose to go there for a particular reason. This is a really good team.
He played great. I don't know if you guys have had the same experience, but anytime you watch Gonzaga play with people who aren't big college basketball fans or sports fans, the number one reaction is, what is the deal with that enormous guy who looks like he's 40 years old? And then it's like a 10-minute conversation about he's from Poland, Szymon Karnowski. It's like his 6th year. He's like a character. I don't mean to otherize Mr. Karnowski, but he's like—
Or Poland.
He's like a character, like a fictional character. He does not—
In a children's fairy tale.
He does not look like a normal basketball player you encounter— particularly in a college game, but he had a dunk. I was like surprised that he could dunk.
Really?
He's like a 7-foot guy. You're like, I don't think you can lift off the ground, but he did. He had a dunk.
Yeah. He's not, I mean, he's pretty good. I like to call him old country. You know, there was a country, but he's old country.
So who do we want to win in the game that will be over by the time many people listen
to this?
Yeah,
why are we subjecting ourselves to this? We're just going to make fools of ourselves.
No, we want Gonzaga. I mean, the North Carolina, and Michael Powell in the New York Times did a nice job of recapitulating and encapsulating the academic scandal that North Carolina sports has been for many years. And that does make me a little more inclined to root for scrappy Gonzaga.
Do you hold that against UNC at all, Joel? Still, to this day?
You know, I'm sort of torn on it. Obviously, like some something really wrong went there. But like, I don't want to be so cynical as to say that this is the sort of thing that happens at most or all college athletic programs. But like, I don't see that as having much to do with the actual kids that are playing.
No, it doesn't.
That said, and it's like Roy Williams and the dadgum thing. And I mean, I'm sure he's a, you know, perfectly delightful person, but I just kind of like it. It's just a little disingenuous to me, that whole dadgum stuff. And, you know, I mean,
you don't think he's really Southern?
Yeah. Is it dadgum or dadgum?
That's a good question. I'm not a huge fan of Roy Williams in that way. That I just like, if you want to be the CEO of this multi-million-dollar program and you say, hey, look, I am in charge here, like that's how it normally works. And then all of a sudden there's an academic scandal of, hey, I didn't know what the hell was going on here. So yeah, I guess I want Gonzaga to win, maybe? I don't know.
All right. It is dadgum, according to the parody Twitter account. So
let's go D-A-G. With that.
G-U-M.
I will be entering it into Merriam-Webster instantly.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
For our last segment, we're going to try to cover a bunch of different things. There were multiple topics we wanted to cover today. Let's start with the Raiders going to Vegas. This is even in the category of bad stadium deals, this is a bad stadium deal. Stefan, what can you tell us about it?
It's a bad stadium deal for the obvious reasons. It enacts a tax to pay for something that other people could pay for. The owner of the Raiders, Mark Davis, is not a wealthy man comparatively. He's only wealthy because he owns the Oakland Raiders. His asset is selling the Raiders. That's where he will make money.
Do we know if he still hangs out at the bar at P.F. Chang's and refers to it as his office?
According to the most recent profile, right?
Yeah.
Which P.F. Chang's is it, though? Is it one in Oakland or is it somewhere else?
I think it's one in Oakland, yeah. And I would hope that there are outlets in Vegas. Maybe we can do some research.
That was probably contingent on the move.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been to that P.F. Chang's if it's the one I'm thinking of, and it's really nice.
Have you seen a guy who looks like he doesn't own the Raiders? Then that's Mark Davis.
Oh. There are a lot of guys in there that look like they don't own the Raiders in that P.F. Chang's.
Did you have more to add on the stadium deal, Stefan?
The cost of the stadium is a record for a stadium, $354 per resident. A lot of that is going to be hit on tourists. There have been some media reports suggesting that that's inequitable too, in as much as it could affect the Strip by taking money from one place and giving it to another place.
Joel, what do you think of having an NFL team in Las Vegas?
I mean, I think it fits. I think and it was inevitable. And if it was going to be an NFL franchise, it should be the Raiders. But, I mean, just think about the idea that, like, to earn any of that $750 million, like, Nevada is going to – essentially, Las Vegas is going to have to count on getting more tourists than they already get now, which doesn't make a lot of sense. Particularly if they have like higher hotel taxes, mm-hmm. that could be the sort of thing. You'd be like, well, I mean, hotels expensive as hell in Vegas. Why would I go now? And I can't imagine that many people are lining up to fly into Vegas to see Derek Carr as opposed to like, you know, Britney Spears or something. or maybe, I don't know. I would probably prefer to see Derek Carr than Britney Spears. So I shouldn't pretend that these people don't.
I love the idea of like Derek Carr having like a standing gig at the Bellagio where he performs like feats of football daring do and card tricks. That would be cool. There is something perfect about the Raiders in Vegas just because the Raiders just seem like kind of, I don't know if scammy is the right word or
skeevy.
Not exactly on the up and up. Like the the fans, like, it seems like a good fit. Like, the people you might see at, like, 3 a.m. in a very dark casino.
Yeah. Casinos are not dark, though. They're very bright to keep you in there.
They want you to be fooled, right? Yeah. They don't want you to know.
Yeah. I mean, the other reason that this is the embodiment of perfect for the NFL is that it exposes the NFL's hypocrisy completely. The NFL, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, was railing about Las Vegas and gambling, and we don't sully ourselves, and we can't be associated in any way with gambling. And here we go. Guess what? Economic exigencies dictate once again that the NFL will take the money and go wherever they choose to go and find a way to try to spin themselves out of it.
Right. It's also really interesting to me, too, and particularly because it's the Raiders, is that the Raiders are a franchise that doesn't really seem to be contingent upon, like, their fandom isn't really contingent upon, like, where they are, right? Like, there's still a lot of, like, fans in Southern California that root for the Raiders. I had a cousin that lived in San Antonio who got Raiders stuff like that. I mean, they were a version of America's team in the way, and for the exact opposite reasons that the Dallas Cowboys were. The Raiders have fans all over this country. They're a well-known franchise. I don't think anybody is going to be like, oh, well, they're not in Oakland anymore. I don't even think of them as necessarily even being an Oakland team. I just think of them being like a truly like a Raider nation of its own, like just sort of floats over, you know, over the West Coast, and, you know, wherever it lands, you know, that just happens to be where they play.
Hey, wherever it lands and it sucks tax dollars out of schools and hospitals, I'm all for that.
Yeah, right, right.
They were 12-4 last year, but it still seemed fake, like just not quite buying the, I guess, they've just been bad for so long that their brand is badness, and it just takes a little while to shake that. But it does feel, I think you're right, Joel, that they do have, because of the logo, because of the colors, because of the history, that they have this outlaw brand that can be reactivated, I think. And Vegas is obviously not going to hurt that outlaw image. And I think if they have a good record, if Derek Carr continues to be good at card tricks and quarterbacking, then it does seem like kind of a good fit between franchise personality and city. We'll see, I suppose. I also wanted to talk about this Tom Haberstroh story about the Tinderization of the NBA, that being the dating app Tinder. And there's a statistical claim in this piece. Says in the 87-88 NBA season, home teams won 68% of games. And circa now, that's all the way down to 57%. And, you know, John Wertheim and Tobias Moskowitz in their book, Scorecasting, argue that home field advantage in all sports is essentially a product of refereeing, just that referees tend to favor home teams. But the thesis here is that a lot of home court advantage, at least back in the day, was players going out clubbing and trying to get with women into the wee hours of the night. And perhaps there's less of a home court advantage now that you can use apps to procure companionship and a much more convenient and time-efficient fashion. Do you buy that, Joel?
That's a really tough... I trust Tom's reporting on this, and I definitely think...
I trust Tom's reporting on this. He clearly has talked to every player
Joel
and all the groupies.
Joel stands by Tom's reporting.
I mean, if Purple is not a reliable source, then I just don't know where.
Yeah, explain to the listeners who Purple is.
Yeah, basically, Purple is your fixer. So you like the story opens in Miami, and there's this guy that's like taking this NBA All Star, unnamed NBA All Star, into Club Live, which is basically, you know, I think at this point, is it the most popular and maybe the most profitable nightclub in the country. And this guy, Purple, could get you into the club, get you in VIP. Like when stars, R&B, you know, rap stars, any celebrity that you can think of wants to have a good time in Miami, they get in contact with this guy, and he can basically procure whatever you want. Alcohol, women, you know, whatever. And so Purple, this is how the story opens. And so I was like, well, obviously, you know, Tom's sources are in order here. I mean, this is the guy that's right at the center. And I follow Purple on Instagram now as a result of that story.
And what kind of content is he providing on Instagram?
Oh, great content. I mean, he goes, it was a little workout Instagram video series the other day that I watched. I mean, he's pretty swole guy. I didn't realize him like that.
Kind of a job requirement.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you would think that if you're going to be in that world, you got to have a little bit of a strong grip, right? I definitely think that, like, there's been a professionalization and in the NBA and all across, like, professional sports where guys, like, are much more in tune with their bodies. Like, there's this really interesting part of the story where Tom talks about how, like, guys don't drink alcohol anymore because it's, like, been proven that alcohol can affect your performance. And so I definitely think that might be as much a part of it as, like, it's just easier to find women off of Instagram now, you know?
Right. And, like, the flights are, you know, better, you know, the better accommodations on
right.
planes. I mean, just to try.
Teams are smarter too. I mean, players have nutritionists.
Right.
They ban alcohol on flights. A lot of teams do because they know its effects. And players recognize that if I suck for 40 of my games, the odds of my being desirable to another NBA team are reduced.
Right.
Yeah. So Zach Lowe was talking about this on a recent podcast about how whenever he goes out and talks to team execs, they, you know, a frequent topic of conversation is like, this guy goes out too much. And so I like the story because that is, I think, clearly it's relevant to team performance, and it's something that front offices and coaches think about, is that this is a part of their teams and players' lives that can affect stuff on the court. And like the procurement of sex and attempts to procure it is like an extremely important part of these guys' lives, you know, a lot of them. And it's just, it's cool to read a story that acknowledges that is a like real thing that happens and doesn't just like pretend that that doesn't exist.
Right. And I think that players also probably are bringing more pressure on each other to do the things that you want to do on the road, but to do them in ways that are less harmful to your performance and the team's performance.
Right. I mean, and procure is strong, right? Because, I mean, these are 6'7" rich dudes. So, like, it can come to them as well. Like, they don't they don't have to spend the night at Liv chasing it. It can come to them. But, yeah, I do like that part of it because we all know these are the sorts of things that we just talk about and we say, oh, man, if it would be awesome to be in the NBA or, you know, or this guy's going to have, you know, trouble adjusting to the road. These are the sorts of things we're talking about, and this sort of lays it out there. And you don't often see that, you know?
Well, when it does surface, it's like in the Derrick Rose case where, you know, the civil suit where he's accused of gang rape. And, it, you know, when, like I said, like when sex comes up, it's often in the context of like a really horrible accusation and not as like a kind of normative thing that like, you know, it's obviously like just a part of life. And the fact that, you know, the way that people date in the world has changed so dramatically in the last decade, obviously it would affect rich and famous people too.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now it is time for After Balls. And when you think of athletic Lotharios, Bo Belinsky always comes to mind for me. Are you familiar with his work?
The Bo Belinsky story?
No.
Yeah. What? I'm looking at the Wikipedia. He was linked romantically at one time or another to such women as Anne Margaret, Connie Stevens, Tina Louise, and Mamie Van Doren.
Ooh.
The last his fiancée for a year. Contemporary player Mike Hagan once said, Bo had more fun off the field than he did on the field. If Tinder existed, maybe he wouldn't have gone 1-7 in 1963. A man out of time. All right, Joel, what is your Bo Bielinski?
Yeah, this is my Bo Bielinski. You might want to call it the Rashawn Holmes of after balls. So
I like that.
Yeah, I want to take a moment to muse upon the NIT champion for a second, because it's made me reconsider the value of coaching and maybe in some ways rethink what I think about how college athletes being compensated should work. But, you know, every year, five major college basketball programs get to end the year with a victory. Not many people get geeked up for the College Basketball Invitational, but hey, somebody has to win it. And this year it was Wyoming over Coastal Carolina. Congrats, Wyoming. And it's worth reminding everyone, or maybe not, I don't know, but Wyoming went 8-10 in the Mountain West, a game behind San Diego State and two behind New Mexico, which just fired its head coach. But, you know, you win a tournament, and that's all that matters. Which leads me to my beloved Horned Frogs, my alma mater, which capped off their first 20-win season in 12 years with a 32-point win over Georgia Tech in the NIT title game last week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, shout out to Lee Nalen, Kurt Thomas, all those guys that paved the way. But, you know, there's been some enthusiasm around our program for, like, the first time in a couple of decades. And that's almost wholly because of the arrival of native son and alum Jamie Dixon, a one-time National Coach of the Year award winner. Now, I don't know if the Sporting News' designation of Coach of the Year matters here, but it does for me for these purposes. But anyway, Jamie has started luring four-star recruits to TCU, and he took the remnants of a roster that finished 2-16 in the Big 12 last year and 8-64 over the previous 4 years and went and finished seventh in the Big 12 this year, which is like whatever you think of it as a football conference, it's a pretty good basketball conference.
Apologies from the LSU Nation for foisting Trent Johnson upon
you. Oh, yeah. We did that to ourselves. We should have known. And hell, you know, 1 year we lost a coach to Ohio. So, you know, it happens. But, you know, Jamie Dixon even beat Kansas this year and the conference tournament. It was our first win over number one team in years. So it made me think about, like, what happened to the place Jamie Dixon left behind, which is Pitt, which finished tied for 14th in the ACC and didn't even make the College Basketball Invitational, which, I mean, it's just a horror. This is a one-year sample for both programs. These aren't trends. They're just a set of data points. But it'd be hard to argue with the idea that Jamie Dixon is invaluable. And so a lot of times we think about, oh, the players are the only things that matter. Like, you've got to have players. It's not the X's and O's. It's the Jimmys and Joes, right? But it actually got me thinking about something that Brian Curtis wrote at The Ringer following the firing of Charlie Strong at the University of Texas. It's that there's no such thing as great programs, just great coaches. And maybe Jamie Dixon isn't great, but he's good enough, and he's made TC relevant for the first time since I graduated, which was a long time ago. So I'm happy. So anyway, that's it.
I'm happy for you.
We're all happy.
Thanks.
I'm happy for Lee Nalen. Stefan.
And Rashawn Holmes.
What is your Bo Bielinski?
The Basketball Hall of Fame over the weekend announced its 2017 class. There's some familiar names. George McGinnis, Tracy McGrady, Rebecca Lobo, Bill Self, Muffet McGraw, Jerry Krause, Nick Gallus. Wait, who? Nick Gallus? Unless you are a fan of Seton Hall in the 1970s, European hoops in the 1980s and 90s, or Greek, you've probably never heard of Nick Gallus. IMC. Gallus grew up in New Jersey. He was the third leading scorer in college in 1978, right behind Larry Bird. He was drafted that year by the Celtics. He sprained an ankle in camp and got cut and decided to play in Greece. I moved to Athens right after college in 1985 and found work at the Associated Press. Gallus by then was a star with Addis in the northern city of Thessaloniki. He was a six-foot gunner, quick, great passer, drove the lane fearlessly, hung in the air, double-clutched and finished. He averaged 31 points in his first season, 44 in his second, and above 35 for the next 10 years, and he dominated the tougher EuroLeague, too. A few months after I arrived, Gallus led the Greek national team to the World Cup final round for the first time, so I wrote a piece for the AP and interviewed Gallus by phone. "We're starting to catch up with the rest of the world," he told me. In competition, Greece was, but the Greek league was a total joke. The competition was shitty. The finances were a disaster. Coaches were terrible. Facilities were worse. That AP story earned me a byline in the International Herald Tribune. Happiest moment of my young journalism life. I'm holding up a photocopy for Josh to look at. The best detail in that story was that there were a total of 3 hardwood courts in the entire country at the time. The top club in Athens, Panathinaikos, played on a green plastic court laid over concrete. But totally thanks to Gallus, the Greeks were getting into basketball. I wound up coming back to the States in the spring of 1987, and one of my biggest career regrets is not staying a few months longer until Greece hosted the 12-team European Championships. The Ethniki Omada went on a crazy run. They beat Italy in the quarterfinals, and then Yugoslavia and Drazen Petrovic in the semis before facing the mighty Soviet Union in the championship game. The Greek TV feed is on YouTube, and it is awesome. The shorts are short, and the nets are too. The crowd is deafening, whistling at every call against Greece, singing, chanting. The Soviets are a really good team. Their lineup includes Alexander Volkov, who would become the first Russian in the NBA and is also on the Hall of Fame, Sarunas Marcelonis, the Lithuanian, who would go on to have a long NBA career, and a gigantic 7'3" dude with a scary mustache named Vladimir Chechenko. But the game is tight all the way. Down 4 with a minute to go, Gallus drops in a runner over the Soviet giant, 89-87. Greece steals. A Greek is fouled. He makes both shots, 89-89. The Soviets make a final shot, but it's just after the buzzer. Bedlam on the court. Overtime. The Soviets again take a lead. Gallus runs the floor, draws a foul, then he drives the lane again and lofts the teardrop over 2 Soviet bigs to put Greece up 101-98 with 45 seconds to go. The announcer is screaming, "Oichi tripondo! Oichi tripondo!" No three-pointer. And a Soviet, of course, drains one with 36 to play. Gallus brings it up, dishes out of a double team with 7 seconds left. There's a missed shot at 6, an offensive rebound at 4, and a foul. Argyris Kamburis drains both shots. The Soviets clang a 3 off the top of the backboard, and Greece wins 103-101. Let's listen.
101-103. Θέλει προσοχή ο Βάλτερς για τον Γιωβάησα σε 3 πόντων. Και η μπάλα έξω. Είναι το τέλος. Η ελληνική ομάδα είναι πρωταθλήτρια Ευρώπης. Η ελληνική ομάδα είναι πρωταθλήτρια Ευρώπης. Είναι μία από τις μεγαλύτερες εκπλήξεις του παγκόσμιου αθλητισμού. Είναι ένας τρίαμος. Είναι ένα ηρωικό κατόρθωμα. Η Ελλάδα πρωταθλήτρια Ευρώπης. Κερδίζοντας 2 φορές τη Σοβιετική Ένωση, την Ιουγκοσλαβία και 1 φορά τη Σοβιετική Ένωση.
The Greek team is champions of Europe. It is one of the biggest surprises in international sports. It is a shock. It is a national achievement. Greece is champion of Europe. Gallus dropped 40 on the Soviets that day 30 years ago, and his legend was sealed. He was known as a pain in the ass. He rarely gave interviews, frequently clashed with coaches and management. He left Addis when the team president wanted him to hang him up and coach. And at 37, his career ended at Panathinaikos when he left a game at halftime because he wasn't getting enough minutes. But that was Gallus, as obstinate and tough off the court as on. Red Auerbach allegedly once said that not signing Nick Gallus was the biggest mistake of his career. NBA teams did come after him a couple of times, but Gallus liked Greece and liked being a star and stayed. After joining the handful of men to make the Hall of Fame, despite never having played in the NBA, Gallus tweeted over the weekend, "Ύψιστη τιμή σε μια από τις καλύτερες στιγμές της ζωής μου είμαι ευγνώμων. The highest honor in one of the best moments of my life, I am thankful." Συγχαρητήρια, Nick Gallus.
Oh, that was moving. Do you think Nick Gallus said it like he dropped 40 on them too?
On the Soviets, yeah.
Do you think he said like, "I dropped 40 on the Soviets"?
Do you either know or suspect that he is Giannis's idol? With no Nick Gallus, there'd be no Giannis Antetokounmpo.
I think that is probably true. He is the idol, actually, of a lot of slightly older players, though I'm sure Gallus was one of Giannis's idols. I mean, the dude is like legend in Greece. Him and the coach of the national team, who was on that 1987 team too, are the man. And the coach just re-upped, so Greece is very excited.
What a fun time in basketball that was. I mean, Oscar Schmidt and this guy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And Oscar Schmidt's one of the other guys in the Hall of Fame that never played in the NBA. Josh, what's your Bo Bielinski?
So over the weekend, Lexi Thompson had a pretty big lead at the first major of the LPGA season. This is women's golf. A couple interesting facts. The LPGA has a major called the ANA Inspiration. Did not know that. The Inspiration. It was also played on the Dynashore tournament course. This is a very, very women's golfy. They're leaning. Women's golf is leaning into being women's golf. So she was up by three on the back nine on Sunday when a rules official approaches her and says, "We were informed by a viewer, a television viewer, that you placed the ball improperly on the 17th hole on Saturday. That's an entirely different day." So they show the replay on television, and as golfers do, she puts the coin down to mark the ball and then puts the ball back like an inch, maybe like a half an inch.
I think it's like more like a half inch.
In front of the coin.
To the left of the coin, yeah.
Conferring absolutely no advantage and there being absolutely no intentionality to this behavior. And nevertheless, she's penalized two strokes for putting the ball in the wrong place and an additional two strokes for signing an incorrect scorecard.
Which was not incorrect when she signed it.
Oh, my God. And to their credit, like the announcers on the broadcast, Mike Tirico included, did not try to hide what was happening. They said, you know, at the end, Thompson eventually ended up losing the tournament despite fighting valiantly to the end. Tirico says it feels like we're crowning the wrong champion. Tiger Woods on Twitter, who has ample time to tweet these days, not competing in the Masters this coming week, says that, you know, this is absurd and this can't happen and, you know, bad on you, golf. But just got to respect golf for just being really into the rules and also being really into time travel. So after I heard this, I placed a few phone calls. Hey, Eric Gregg. Oh, unfortunately, he's no longer living. But hey, Eric Gregg, 1997 National League Championship Series, Game 5, that strike call on Fred McGriff on that Levon Hernandez pitch, we're going to have to take that back. I watched it on TV, and that was well outside the strike zone. We're going to have to run back the entire 1997 National League season. Raiders, Patriots, Tom Brady, Tuck Rule, 2001 AFC playoffs. We looked at the replay. We now have enhanced HD capabilities. That was, in fact, a fumble. We're going to have to start it again at 13-10, and we're just going to have to run back the next 16 seasons.
I would like to see that. Those the same players out there. Hey.
Oh, man.
Today.
Yeah. The Houston Oilers got jobbed in the AFC Championship in 1980 on a touchdown catch by Mike Renfro. So I'd love to see, you know, them suit up, you know, Franco Harris and just get all those guys out back there.
Roy Jones Jr., Park Si-hun, Seoul Olympics in 1988. Probably the canonical referee jobbing of the last 30 years, at least since the 1972 USSR basketball game. But wait, I made a phone call. We're going back to Seoul. It's 1988 again. Roy Jones Jr., you have a second chance. But the reason that you can even plausibly do this, even though it's absurd, is that golf is a rare sport where, I guess cricket is another example, where you have a multi-day tournament where you just pick up where you left off the previous day. So it's not like, you know, Lexi Thompson won on Saturday and you're like, oh, you need to redo the round. It's like you have a cumulative score over 4 days. So you can, even though it's stupid and horrible, you can, you know, dock four strokes and just keep on going. So here's my suggestion for how to ruin sports. Basketball, I think, is the natural. You could totally ruin basketball by having a playoff series where, you know, say Joel's Rockets in game one, we review the tape and like, oh, actually, we didn't see, you know, Nick Anderson's, oh, no, there was a lane violation. You know, I saw the replay. I'm going to call in during the third quarter of game two of the NBA Finals. There was a lane violation in game one. Cumulative scoring in NBA playoff series. Let's make it happen. We need to ruin more sports by allowing fans to call in and retroactively tell the referees they made bad calls. What? This is a great idea.
I mean, an idea. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, the NFL would actually go for it. So
any excuse you can have to just go under the hood. We love going under the hood. We'd love your feedback on what we talked about today. I think we solved a lot of problems in sports with this last afterball. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe to Hang Up and Listen on iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Also, take our survey, slate.com/survey. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Thank you to Joel Anderson for being our guest today. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Our intern is Adam Willis. Our producer is Patrick Fort. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.